Hey, y'all, welcome to the show. It's already time for the show again. Here I am. It's the Scott Horton Show here on Liberty Radio Network. Got John Neffel coming up on the show to talk about the drone war. Oh, it's still raging all around the world, you know. And Jacob Hornberger will be here to talk about immigration and all the kids being held in giant federal cages down there at the border. I really don't know that much about it, but Jacob's going to explain. Where was that article of his anyway? It's around here somewhere. He's got a new one today. Who are the Patriots now? Quite justifiably. Still resentful against all the, the political class and all the Americans who hopped on board with him in denouncing everyone who knew better. Back during the invasion of Iraq in the first few years of the Iraq War. In case you're young, you might not know, but it's important history. George Bush was still the good guy, and you were still the jerk if you disagreed with him about anything up until and through the Hurricane Katrina disaster. And only after the summer of 2005 was it finally plausible in media that maybe these guys aren't the best and the brightest leaders of humanity ever. And possibly someone could have a substantive criticism about, you know, a policy of theirs. But that's how long that their blank check lasted. And it wasn't just the media, it was the people too. To such an embarrassing degree. Hundreds of millions of them, well, 150 million of them at least, were for the Iraq War. So, tens and tens and tens and tens of millions of Americans went around denouncing their neighbors as cowards and traitors and pro-terrorists for knowing better than sending the government in to overthrow the secular fascist, atheist, Ba'athist dictator, Saddam Hussein, who never believed in Islam any more than a talking point, like Bill Clinton going to Methodist church, who had only one God, himself. Oh yeah, we gotta stop him from giving the weapons to the terrorists. And you like terrorists if you disagree with that. Anyway, yeah, good old Jacob. So he's saying, oh yeah, nope, turns out we were the ones who were the patriots and you were the guys who screwed over America and Iraq and everybody else. Which, of course, is correct. As long as you can put aside your fear and your ignorance and your bloodlust and think for just a minute, it was pretty clear the case for war wasn't really a case for war at all. He might have weapons that he might give to terrorist groups that he has no relationship with whatsoever, no reason to trust or work with whatsoever, huh? And that's why we have to start a war, huh? Yeah. And it's true that they lied to you, but still, if you believed it, when 150 million Americans didn't, then explain that. I mean, if you were a little kid at the time, then I guess you got an excuse, but assuming you were of the age of majority, I even knew a guy who said, hey, listen, America gave him those chemical weapons. It's our responsibility to go in there and get them. Yeah, well, there's a thing called shelf life, dude, and it's expired. Even super special magic Ronald Reagan chemical weapons were null and void. Actually, no longer existed, but would have been null and void by 2003 anyway. Weapons of mass destruction. All right, anyway, Jacob Hornberger is going to be on. But I'm going to ask him about the drug war in Mexico and the immigration policy and economics and the police state and the state. Now, Jacob's not an anarchist. Jacob thinks that it's possible to have a limited constitutional republic if only we could get rid of this national security state. And I have to admit that I can kind of see that argument as being appealing. Wow, you know what? Never even mind anarchy. What if we just had normalcy for a minute? What if we just had peacetime? What if we could just stop having our government tell us to be afraid of everything all the time. The drugs are going to get you. The Arabs are going to get you. The whoever's going to get you if they don't help you. Your doctor is going to get you. They don't help you. Can we just have a normal country in a normal time for just a little while? I don't know. Makes sense. Just get rid of the national security state. At least it's a good start. The problem is there's no such thing as a limited constitutional republic, because what limited? It's not really in any of the three branches' interest to stop the other branches from running roughshod over the people, just over their own branch. But that's okay. They can work out an equilibrium where they all, you know, triple team us. Gang rape. So, of course, it was Congress that passed the National Security Act of 1947. I say abolish the Congress. It was the Congress that passed the Federal Reserve Act. Abolish the Congress. It was the state legislatures that ratified the income tax amendment. Well, sorta. Abolish the state legislatures. And the governors and the rest of them. That's my position. I'm just being honest. Jacob thinks, hey, we could settle for a limited constitutional republic. He could. If we could just get rid of the national security state. Okay. That's like 99% of the way to anarcho-capitalism from here. No, okay. But it's like 75% of the way. I'd settle. You know what? Honestly, if Jacob Hornberger could somehow institute a temporary limited constitutional republic in America with a rule of law and all that kind of mythological stuff, I would go on vacation for a couple of weeks. I'm not saying my work would be finished forever, but I could settle for a little while. You know, that's my thing. Anyway, so Hornberger's going to be on to talk about the huddled masses. He's on the side of the huddled masses against power, lo and behold. So that'll be coming on. And then John Neffel will be on about the drone war. It's not just in Iraq, but, you know, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda. Sometimes we bomb them. We being, you know, the U.S. government. Yeah, yeah. Sometimes the U.S. government backs Al-Qaeda, and sometimes we don't. And like the bumper sticker says, the bumper sticker that I invented. Well, it made up. I don't know, invented. Anyway, so in some of the wars where America's still at war with Al-Qaeda, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, we got the robots killing people all day long. Oh, not just killing Al-Qaeda guys like you might wish to assume, but nah, killing innocent people all the time in a brutal and lawless fashion. And, well, I don't want to spoil it for you, but John Neffel's going to come up and make a couple of points on that here on the show in a little while. Obama, as I said, well, actually, I may have to bump John because Obama's going to give a talk, and I think I want to hear it. He's going to announce, according to Barbara Starr at CNN, he's going to announce sending 100 special forces. They said, Barbara Starr said Rangers and Navy SEALs. So, okay. I don't know. First and second tier special forces. JSOC guys and SOCOM guys. Can I bump you 15 minutes for dear leader? The leader is going to announce he's going back to war in Iraq. Oh, no, they're just trainers and advisors and things like that. Special Forces going back to Iraq. The president's going to announce it in 15 minutes. Stay tuned. I'll pirate this signal from CNN for you. God dang world. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here, and I'm so excited about commodity discs from commoditydiscs.com. They're 1 ounce silver pieces with a QR code engraved on the backside. Scan the code with your phone and get the instant spot price. Commodity discs are paving the way forward for the alternative currency community in America and around the world. The QR code commodity disc. Technology has now finally made a real free market silver currency viable. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one free. That's commoditydiscs.com. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. This is hilarious. Remember that article I was telling you about yesterday by our friend Yosef Butt at armscontrollaw.com, where he was going through and just completely destroying all the accusations against Iran, most of them laundered through this hack, fake scientist, fake physicist, fake IAEA weapons inspector, David Albright at ISIS. No, not the suicide bombers, but just as bad, the Institute for Pseudoscience and International Security and International Warmongering Insecurity. But anyway, so David Albright thought it would be a good idea to fight with Albright in the comment section here. I mean, Albright decided it would be a good idea to fight with Butt in the comment section here at armscontrollaw.com. What is the quality of the scientific evidence against Iran? Is the article, and here they are going back and forth in the comment section here, and it's pretty funny. I haven't finished it. I don't know how to characterize it all yet, but I thought it was it was pretty definitive what Yosef wrote yesterday. I only just was looking at the comment section here during the break, so I don't really know, but Albright is certainly a hack. And as Gordon Prather says, Albright's always been a fraud. And Prather's a guy who absolutely is not. Prather is the former chief scientist of the Army, former nuclear weapons designer for the U.S. Navy and Energy Department, Lawrence Livermore and Sandia, and blah, 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 and on like that. And he always just made fun of Albright, this guy who was allowed to tag along on a weapons inspection in Iraq a couple of times and then pretended to be an IAEA weapons inspector after that. This guy who's got a bachelor's degree in basket weaving, going around pretending that he's some kind of a nuclear physicist. And the thing is, I think he does have one achievement to his name, Albright, and that is he had made some discoveries that the IAEA had missed, or had pointed out some information that they had missed in their own reports or something about what the South Africans were up to in their nuclear weapons program. So that was his one success in life, and then it doesn't matter how many times he gets everything wrong since then, because everything that he says is perfectly quotable by the Joby Warwicks of the world in the Washington Post and the David Sangers in the New York Times and George John in the AP. When they need a scare quote for the war party about what Iran could, might be, possibly up to if you take DMT and space out real bad, they go to him. So he'll never be discredited, because he's always wrong in favor of what the Empire wants to do. See how that works? Pretty funny. And anyway, it's too bad. I don't know. Maybe I'll get a chance to finish reading the comments in the break, and then I'll be able to characterize the discussion better. But it seems pretty funny to me. And you know, Yosef Butt has written for the last couple of years about Iran's nuclear program and has done a real good job on it. I haven't found flaw in it. And I ain't perfect, but I try to be extra critical of the things that I would tend to lean toward, right? You know, to try to preempt my own confirmation bias as best I can, if I can. And Yosef Butt, he just seems to really have his act together. He's a great writer. He's obviously, you got to be some kind of genius to be a nuclear physicist in the first place. And he actually is one. like Gordon Prather and unlike David Albright. And so anyway, that's again at Arms Control Law, if you want to read that little bit of bickering on the Iranian nuclear issue from a scaremonger and a scaremonger debunker. All right, now, a couple more things on Iran's nuclear program as long as I'm talking about it. And Obama is coming up in just a minute. He may start during the commercial break, but I'm going to play, you know, as much as I can for you in the next segment of Obama's statement on reinvading Iraq. I don't know, man. But so Greg Thielman, who helped try to truth you out of war with Iraq, but failed, unfortunately, from formerly with the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research, debunker of the aluminum tubes lie. And Robert Wright, who I think typically writes for The Atlantic, was just a journalist, not an expert, if I have my story straight. But here they are, Thielman and Wright in Slate.com, The Trouble with Breakout Capacity, How Widely Misunderstood Term Could Doom the Iran Nuclear Negotiations. And they talk about how, well, as Yosef Butt talked about on the show last week, how it's kind of problematic that, you know, it really is kind of a generic term. If you're, you know, it can be understood different ways. But having a breakout capacity is not really the same thing as having a nuclear weapons capacity. And having weapons-grade uranium, even if they did break out and have weapons-grade uranium, doesn't mean that they actually have a usable nuclear weapon. And they don't really... I mean, they kind of, sort of, I think in too general of a way, they refer to the difference between a small missile deliverable, miniaturized implosion system, a very sophisticated device, as Governor Keating might say, or a simple gun type nuke. And the difference is between Fat Man and Little Boy, that's all. The Hiroshima bomb was a gun type nuke. It's basically a uranium shotgun slug fired into a uranium target pit and then blammo. It's not that difficult to put together, assuming you have the uranium and the ability to, you know, the machine tools and whatever to get it all together. But compared to a plutonium bomb, an implosion bomb, it's a much simpler device. And so they don't really, I think they assume that if the Iranians are going to make a nuke here, it would be an implosion system and much more difficult for them to build and would take much longer. And that kind of makes sense if the assumption is they would have to fit it onto a missile somehow to deliver it somewhere, because otherwise, who the hell are they going to nuke? They're going to put a nuke on an airliner and sneak it over to Tel Aviv somehow or something? And give me a break. But anyway, what they're saying is, in this article, is that there's basically a false distinction, a false definition being set up about breakout capacity, and it could be used to thwart the nuclear deal, which the Iranians are clearly willing to sign. And so we shouldn't let that happen, and boy, do I agree with that. All right, the president lying to you about why he's going back to Iraq next.
This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show.
Here's Albright admitting defeat. For those who are interested in our responses on these questions raised by Mr. Butt, in particular, the AP graphs, Parchin, the debate with the Federation of American Scientists over the Fordo facility, the Kushab reactors, the ring magnets, and the explosive bridge wires, well, I would refer you back to my own website. You go over there and just do your research. Yeah, in other words, nailed. I don't know why he even bothered answering back again on this. This David Albright is so ridiculous. You know, Gareth Porter, we're still waiting for Dear Leader to get up there and give his war speech coming up in just a minute. But, you know, Gareth Porter just ran this piece the other day about how, oh, Albright doesn't believe the lies that he tells, and here's the proof of it. Here he is admitting that he thinks this, this, and that evidence is weak and maybe, you know, raises severe questions about their providence and, you know, whether these are even legitimate documents that raise these questions in the first place. And then he goes right on pretending like it's all perfectly legit and real and whatever later on. Even after he was the guy who called out Broad and Sanger, Sanger and Broad, in the New York Times on their, you know, ridiculous coverage of the weapon, the warhead, where they didn't even distinguish between a warhead and a delivery vehicle, and how in either case they screwed it all up anyway. And as Gareth Porter pointed out, they were already, the Iranians were already working on a completely different missile with a completely different nose cone, which would have required a completely different warhead and delivery vehicle if they had actually been working on any such thing at all. But you can see why the foragers didn't know that, because that wasn't out yet at the time that they foraged it. Nice try, Israel, but you got caught by Gareth Porter. And anyway, David Albright's caught out by Gareth Porter and here by Yosef Butt as well at armscontrollaw.com, just obliterating Albright's innuendo and propaganda off the face of the earth with his bogus charts and his nonsense. Will Congress get in the way of an Iran deal? Asks Ali Gharib at The Nation. And yes, I'm stalling. I'm talking about Iran right now. I guess I could be talking about Iraq, but the Iran thing is important too. It's part of the Iraq story, even though obviously I'm talking about the nuclear program part here more. But I'm basically stalling until Dear Leader gets up there and gives his stupid speech where he's going to declare war on Iraq again. Again. Oh, well, they're asking for us to bomb them. They being very vaguely defined as Maliki is asking for America to bomb his enemies. So we're invited, so it's okay. I wonder if he's going to sign an immunity deal for any war crimes that the Americans commit while they're in country. That was the sticking point back 3 years ago, you remember. Well, we want to stay, but you have to give us immunity so that when our guys commit war crimes and massacre civilians in your country, that they will not be under threat of accountability. I mean, that was literally the argument that they made. That was the sticking point. Look, our guys are going to commit war crimes. We all recognize that. The question is whether you are going to have the temerity to try to hold them accountable. Because we are not going to have that. And if you won't give our guys a license to kill innocent people, then I'm afraid we're not going to be able to stay and help you. Yep, that's how they work. So I wonder, yeah, is there going to be a new status of forces agreement? The top headline on antiwar.com today, and this was, I saw them talking about this on CNN earlier, although I wasn't listening, but it was the title down at the bottom of the screen was Obama to Congress, I don't need your okay on Iraq. Jason Ditz at news.antiwar.com writes, earlier this year, President Obama gave tentative support to the idea of repealing the authorization for use of military force against Iraq, noting that the war was over. Congress never pulled the trigger, with hawks arguing against it. Tonight, on the eve, last night, on the eve of new U.S. military operation in Iraq, President Obama is arguing he doesn't need any congressional authority for his new foray into Iraq, since the old AUMF is still on the books. And that is according to CNN reporting there, he's linking to. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell and House Democratic Leader Nancy Pelosi agreed with this assessment, saying the AUMF still applied and that Obama was just telling congressional leaders what he plans to do. President Obama has long downplayed the need for congressional approval for his military ventures and publicly eschewed any vote on U.S. involvement in the attack on Libya, saying NATO's decision to attack obliged the U.S. to war no matter what Congress thought. The administration's exact intentions on Iraq remain unclear as they have withheld public pledges trying to coax Iraqi reforms and, most recently, the ouster of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. They've ruled out combat troops, but seem to be willing to split hairs by arguing that the ground troops they do send won't technically be combat troops. Here's what's funny about that. Finding ways to stay in Iraq by me. From March 2009. Those who bought into the slogans hope and change last fall should have read the fine print. We were warned over and over again during the campaign for the presidency. Barack Obama made it clear that, quote, withdrawal from Iraq on his flexible 16-month timetable meant only the removal of combat forces. He also made it clear all along that combat forces means whatever he wants it to mean until he decides to change his mind. At least he's honest. On Friday, Obama announced in a speech at Camp Lejeune that 16 months have become 18, that 50,000 soldiers and Marines will be continuing the occupation until 2012 under the guise of training Iraqi army and police forces, counterterrorism, and force protection. No mention was made of the largest embassy one nation has ever built in another, the future use of air power, or the 100,000-plus contractors and mercenaries still inside the country. These glaring omissions, along with the announced intention to maintain 50,000-plus troops in the country after the summer of 2010, add up to nothing but a ruse, a loophole for mission creep right back to full-blown occupation, since many of the troops scheduled to leave the country will only be headed off to another war zone in Afghanistan and Pakistan. The entire exercise may end up amounting to nothing but an escalation of the Afghanistan occupation, while the door is left wide open for more troops to be sent back into Iraq. And now, okay, I'll concede that it took them a little longer to get back to reinvading. But other than that, how do you like that? That was me 5 years ago. At antiwar.com. Finding ways to stay in Iraq. In fact, my original title was, "Who is this jerk think he's kidding?" And Matt Bargain here. He fixed up the title for me. Thanks, Matt. Finding ways to stay in Iraq by me back then. And it's true that I said, come on, now that the Sunni tribes have whooped them, the idea that Al-Qaeda in Iraq is going to come back in any major way is ridiculous. Well, I guess I underestimated Obama's will to obey Netanyahu's will in backing ISIS. Al-Qaeda in Iraq, in Syria. And building them up to be such a force that they can come in and make trouble for America's sock puppets, former sock puppets in Iraq. So, had me wrong there. All right. Anyway, I'm going to email John Neffel and I'm going to try to bump him for another little while. I think maybe that phone ringing was FFF maybe bumping me. I don't know, but I want to hear what Dear Leader has to say, whether it's during the commercial break or not, and then we'll interview John Neffel after that, maybe. Anyway, it's the show. Hang around. Hey, everybody. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. If you're like me, then you're right all the time, surrounded by people in desperate need of correction. Well, we can't all have a radio show, but we can all get anti-government propaganda to stick on the back of our trucks. Check out LibertyStickers.com. Categories include anti-war, empire, police state, libertarian, Ron Paul, gun rights, founders quotes, and of course, the stupid election. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right. Well, this idiot Barack Obama, this scumbag, loser, murderer, liar, piece of trash, who's the emperor of the planet Earth, is rewriting his script, I guess. Has his little Smitherses rewriting his script for him before he announces the reinvasion of Iraq. Oh, it's just gonna be 100 guys. Well, and I'm sorry to John Neffel. I keep trying to bump him because I'm waiting for the president to talk. I guess I should have brought the guy on and whatever first. But anyway, let me... there's so much news. Let me just mention real quick. Later on in the show, we're going to talk about this terrorist case out of Round Rock and Austin, Texas. Really? They already said in the CNN report that there was an FBI undercover informant involved. So that's it. Simple as that. It was a put-up entrapment job. Don't be an idiot. Oh, no. There was a real terrorist with a real terrorist plot, and the FBI just happened to cross them and happened to infiltrate them with a sting operation that then, you know, was successful. And yeah, right. When they say undercover, you say entrapment, sting operation, invented plot by the federal government, just like always. By the way, your friend, the idiot with the bright idea about who you guys should go kill and how much he loves Osama and is offering you money to say that you love Osama too, that guy's a cop. Stop listening to him, you stupid idiot. Are you really that desperate to make friends that you can allow yourself to be infiltrated by an undercover informant trying to trick you into saying something stupid into a microphone? Saying something stupid into a microphone is my job. Don't fall for it. 50 times, more than 50 times this has happened, as documented by Trevor Aronson in his book, The Terror Factory. And I'm here to tell you, when real veterans of ISIS come to America to kill civilians, you can count on the FBI to be jerking each other off, entrapping some idiot, know-nothing, nobody, into a fake plot. Where's the FBI? Oh, they're busy persecuting antiwar.com and the Occupy movement and entrapping some dumbass kid into saying, fine, fine, I love Osama then, I guess. Can I have my $50,000 now? FBI informant, new best friend of mine. What a joke. Yeah, your new best friend in the whole world who you can't figure out why this guy thinks that you're so cool. But man, he just won't stop hanging around you and telling you how much he loves you and offering to get you into terrible trouble. No, he couldn't possibly be working for the FBI or anything. It's not like they've got an MO. And meanwhile, Barack Obama is saying, we got to send more help to the rebels. And what are these guys accused of? They want to go help the rebels fight in Syria. Well, which is it, Barack Obama government? Are the Al-Qaeda-loving or ex-Al-Qaeda-loving terrorists of Syria in Nusra and ISIS, the suicide bombers, the prisoner beheaders, those who crucify their enemies to death in the town square like this was ancient times, are they terrorists or are they good guys? Oh, no, it's the FSA moderates that are the good guys. But the guys who are actually fighting the war, those are the terrorists. So if only these entrapped idiots in Round Rock had told, in here in Austin somewhere, had told their undercover FBI informant that we want to go fight with the moderates in Syria against Assad instead of with the extremists in Syria against Assad, then that would have been just fine. One of these guys, remember 2 years ago, this kid was indicted because he wanted to go and fight, well, maybe 1 year ago, he wanted to go and fight with the terrorists in Syria. And was indicted, and his father came out and said, no, he was recruited by the CIA to go fight over there. What do you mean he's guilty of material aid and comfort and support to the terrorist enemies when... But the CIA were the ones who recruited him to go. Now, I never found out what happened with that. In fact, I just thought of it again for the first time since then, I guess. I don't know. But sure sounded plausible at the time, right? But then what's the DOJ going to do? Back down? Well, actually, this guy was really good at procuring weapons and stuff. So, yeah, we wanted him to go with those who crucify their enemies to death in the town square. because, you know, on the Syrian side of the former border, they're the good guys. Anyway, I'm listening to CNN. CNN goes, two people arrested in Texas by the FBI, I mean anywhere in the USA, by the FBI on a terrorist plot. And I'm just ticking the seconds off of my fingers, not literally, but I'm just sitting here waiting. All right, stop reading your article, look at the TV, and wait for a minute. And how long is going to go by? How long do we have to wait before they say the magic word? They're not even shy anymore. They don't even cover it up. I don't know why. How long do we have to go before they say the magic word? FBI informant. Oh, really? So there was a terrorist plot, and there was an FBI informant, and I bet you $1 million. Might as well, because I know I'm right. 99.999999%. That everything illegal, or certainly all the worst things illegal, in the presentment, in the charges, were the FBI informant's fault. His idea. Just the same as in Lodi, California, poor Hamid Hayat. Same thing as the Miami 7. Same thing as the Detroit... No, those guys were just perjured against by a guy facing a life sentence. Same thing as the Fort Dix pizza plot. Same thing as the JFK... fuel depot explosions plot. Same thing as the Brooklyn Bridge with a blowtorch plot. Just some idiot. That one's my favorite because it's, I don't know if we already knew this or not, but it came out in the front line the other day that this was the case that Michael Hayden used to convince the New York Times to withhold the NSA spying story until after Bush was safely reelected in 2004. In fact, they still sat on the story until it was about to come out in James Risen's book. We already knew that part. But I think that I learned for the first time in that front line that when the New York Times, they were invited to the White House, they shouldn't have even gone. They went to the White House to let Bush, and Bush was sitting right there in the Oval Office, and then they let Michael Hayden, the head of NSA that 9/11 happened on his watch, give the speech to the New York Times that this tool is absolutely indispensable. And you want to know what terrorist plot we stopped with it? This retarded kid was going to bring down the Brooklyn Bridge with a blowtorch. And because of NSA illegal warrantless spying, we stopped him. And that impressed Bill Keller enough to withhold the story. I've grown up a little bit, and I don't usually say this too often, but I think it would be great if Bill Keller shot himself in the head to death. Wouldn't that be hilarious? If he just said, you know what, I'm just not fit to live on this planet anymore. Sorry, everybody. Bang! Because what? Because the FBI informant tricked the slowest kid at the Islamic bookstore into saying that he would try to attack the Brooklyn Bridge. That was an FBI, that was an NSA victory. An NSA victory significant enough to convince the New York Times to withhold the NSA story to get Bush reelected. 1 million zillion counts of federal felony violations of the FISA statute. What a joke, Bill Keller. And you know what's funny, too, is I don't guess I'd ever seen a picture of Bill Keller before. He was just an abstraction to me before. But then when I saw that interview of him, I just wanted to smack that bastard right in the face. And I don't think that that would be a violation of the non-aggression principle either. What if I used the back of my hand so that it was really a lot more of an insult than an actual physical assault? Would that be all right then? The editor of the newspaper of record of the planet, huh? What a disgrace of a human being. All right. Well, Obama's half an hour late to announce his criminal conspiracy to mass murder more Iraqis. Tune it to CNN. It might come on during the top of the hour here. Horenberger coming up soon. Neffel maybe tomorrow. I don't know. I already bumped him twice, so. We'll be back.
Hey, y'all, Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1-ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks.
I am so sick of Barack Obama, man. I just bumped Jacob Hornberger till tomorrow. Because I don't want to ruin the Hornberger interview by interrupting it with Obama, who they claim for the last 40 minutes is prepared to declare war on Iraq. Oh, I mean, he's going to send some advisors back in there, yeah. So, I bumped John Neffel twice. Bumped Jacob Hornberger all the way till tomorrow. I plan on interviewing John Neffel at the bottom of this hour. Because surely Dear Leader will have announced his pronouncements. Pronounced his announcements? I guess both. By then. I can hear the grandmothers weeping now. From, you know, when Barack Obama explodes their grandchildren to death. He's really good at killing people. Ask him, he'll tell you. Those are his exact words. Oh, yeah. Well, I guess I could talk about the Cheney thing for a minute. I'm actually very grateful. Don't tell the war party this. Very grateful that Dick Cheney and Liz Cheney are out in front criticizing Barack Obama. And for that matter, I'm very grateful that Paul Wolfowitz and Zalmay Khalilzad and Paul Bremer and the neoconservatives, even Doug Feith, Judith Miller, all these war party alums from the Iraq War are coming out so front and center to support the aggressive policy here. I mean, it's going to happen anyway. But it seems to me like it's almost sabotage. I mean, if I could pick my favorite, my very best pick for spokesman for the war party, not that I want him ever having power, but as far as spokesmen go, I want Dick Cheney out front. I want the American people to identify this imperial cause with guys like him. With him, specifically. By the time they left office, his approval rating was 10 or 15 points lower than Bush's. And he has no credibility whatsoever. And, you know, poor Megyn Kelly on Fox News interviewed Dick and his daughter, Liz Cheney, last night. And she had no choice but for her own credibility's sake. And yeah, believe me, that it's not lost on me that this is 11 years too late for Fox News. But Megyn Kelly on Fox News has no choice but to come out there and challenge Dick Cheney. She just can't let Dick Cheney get up there and say, yeah, do everything my way. And she didn't write her own talking points. She's obviously reading a piece of paper and whatever, because, what, she's not a journalist. She's just a TV hairdo type. An anchor. A newsreader, they call them in Britain, where they're a little bit more honest. But so she says, yeah, but you said this and you said that. And you were wrong. That's where we are now in American politics. It's amazing how long it took. You know, I said it took until Hurricane Katrina. Hell, it took until this to get Fox News to say that, you know what, invading in the first place may have been the biggest cause of all the problems. And it's unfortunate she accused him of too many things in a row for him to have to confront them all. But at the same time, he looks like a coward for only answering one. He resorts to saying to Megyn Kelly that, well, you know, After 9/11, the threat that he could give weapons of mass destruction to terrorists was something that we had to confront, or what? That's really all he's got. First draft. Talking point. Nonsense. That's all he's got? That he could give weapons of mass destruction to Osama? Really? And then, but he didn't answer because he couldn't answer. So he used the loophole that she had asked too many, she had accused him of too many things at once to only answer one. But it also, I think he came out looking pretty bad too, that he couldn't answer about saying that the insurgency was in its last throes 9 years ago in 2005. And I forget what the other ones were that she brought up. But anyway, so Dick Cheney and Liz Cheney are now even making a whole new front group, which I guess, you know, will coexist at Bill Kristol's office with the other six or seven neoconservative so-called think tanks, you know, on a piece of paper in his right-hand desk drawer. And anyway, it's going to be, they even put out, this is so funny, dude. It's almost like someone's playing a prank on these two, man. I'm just looking. Did you see this? The Alliance for a Strong America here?
For Islamic terrorists. It's since the attacks of 9/11.
It's Dick Cheney and Liz Cheney standing in Wyoming out there in the sunshine with a fake backdrop. Of being out in the country with mountains and trees and all this stuff. Dick Cheney wearing a brown vest and a cowboy hat.
America is the exceptional nation, and that there is no substitute.
Oh, yeah, and then this is the thing. Now, wait a minute. Liz starts talking. So, I guess I could try to play the whole thing. First of all, just the scene here. Dick Cheney and his daughter, who's his exact clone, announcing the creation of the Alliance for a Strong America. Like, none of us can conceive that this is the guy, more than any other, who has conspired to blow America's entire wad at the end of the Cold War with the Soviet Union. He blew the entire unipolar moment to smithereens in the sands of Iraq for nothing. This guy. And everyone knows it. And him and his daughter are talking about, you know, I guess it's just up to us that we have to do this to make sure that the job gets done, that we need an alliance for a strong America because of all this weakness going on around here. Like, it wasn't him and Bush that left with the Status of Forces Agreement that expired at the end of 2011, back in 2008. So they do this, but then the get-up. I mean, who produced this thing with Dick Cheney in his cowboy hat and his vest and way too much makeup on his pink, rosy cheeks? He's got so much makeup on in this clip, and it's one of these, like, 1080p or whatever, where it's just, it's too real, man. It's too real for my computer screen. I can't stand it, but I love it. And it's just like I said back in 2006, I said, I finally get George Bush's foreign policy. Well, let me see if I got it here. I think it was the first thing I say on this clip, if I have it. Yeah, here it is. Is it here? Is it going to work? Do I have enough time before the music starts? I finally figured out the Bush administration's foreign policy. To so discredit foreign interventionism that we'll from now on mind our own business. All right. Okay. So that was from the spring of 2006. There you go. These are the best proponents of world empire that they got themselves. Just the Cheneys. And, I think it's hilarious that they're creating a new think tank and that they're out front and that they're bringing all their neocon friends, Robert Kagan and Fatneck Fred and his hideous wife, both of their hideous wives, Well, like I said, Khalil Zod, Fife, I don't know, they bring Abram Shulsky out, and Bill Lutie. We need to go back to Iraq, huh? Say the guys that overthrew the atheist, turned the west of the country over to the bin Ladenites, and the east of the country over to the Iranians. Yeah, you guys sure know what you're talking about, huh? Well, it's what Ariel Sharon's rotting, stinking corpse wanted. So it's all right. More Obama declaration of war next on The Scott Horton Show, maybe.
Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com.
Man, that pisses me off. Jack Hunter has put out a thing on Rare.us saying, hey, look, here's Dick Cheney from 1994 agreeing with Rand Paul. And it's the clip that I played on the show for you last week. Of Dick Cheney in 1994, that was unearthed by C-SPAN back in, what, 08 or whatever, arguing why the Bush senior administration didn't go, quote, all the way to Baghdad and overthrow Saddam, because the Sunni West might break off with Syria, the South and East might break off with Iran, and who knows what would happen with Kurdistan, and we'd be occupying Baghdad, bogged down, and getting our guys sniped in urban warfare, in a quagmire, and it ain't worth it, and et cetera like that. But that's not what what Rand Paul's position on Iraq is, to leave it alone or to stay out. Rand Paul last week said, go ahead and bomb him. Go ahead and bomb him, he said. So Jack Hunter's got some nerve to pretend that Rand Paul is a peacenik and a non-interventionist on Iraq when he's on the record last week saying, yeah, bomb him. When Dick Cheney agreed with Rand Paul. How about when Rand Paul agreed with Dick Cheney the other day? Never mind 1994. When Dick Cheney was on the defensive arguing his president's position, of course, he wanted to go all the way to Baghdad back in 91. He was on the side of the Hawks. Bush Sr. stood him down. In 94, somebody put him on the spot on camera. Instead of betraying the president that he served under, he argued the president's position for why not to go all the way to Baghdad. I could be wrong about that, but I'm pretty sure I'm not. I think he wanted to go all the way to Baghdad, as Wolfowitz and the rest of the neocons were advising at the time, regime change against Hussein that Bush Sr. resisted. But regardless, it's still 1994 where he's defending Bush Sr. And it makes a great point. I used it to illustrate a great point myself, that all this was foreseeable, and in fact, by the ringleader of the plot, Cheney himself, could articulate perfectly well what kind of horrible chaos could result from the toppling of the regime in Baghdad by outside forces, by American forces. It's a good thing to illustrate. But to try to use that to acquit Rand Paul, to try to pretend that Rand Paul is leading the peace party on this one? No, Rand Paul, like always, puts his personal ambition first. And someone must have told him that they think his personal ambition would be 1% better off if he would say, I'm open to bombing. So he said, I'm open to bombing. To bombing. People. To death. Bombing them. That's Rand Paul's position. And you know, it's funny. I knew this guy who was always like, he was always coming out with conspiracy stuff, but from a sarcastic kind of thing. And saying, oh, Scott Horton, I know you work for Rand Paul. And you're playing the Hegelian dialectic. Thesis, antithesis, synthesis. trying to always be the hardcore anti-war critic of Rand Paul to make him look moderate no matter how radically anti-war he is. Oh, were only that true, I could afford, you know, a haircut and gas in my truck. A tax stamp for my windshield. Which the tax stamps are getting incredibly expensive these days. If only Rand Paul would pay me to pretend to be his opposition, I'll just go on opposing him all this time. And you know, here's the thing. I understand that whole dialectical type of thing. And how, yeah, you're supposed to run to the right in the primaries if you want to win the primaries and all that American politics crap. But what I think, and I already said this the other day, but I'm right, so I'm saying it again. And also, I think it's important. I think, and you know, I think it's possible that maybe someone will hear a little bit about it, mention it to him, something that if only he would actually be brave and lead, then people would follow him. And I don't mean, you know, lead in the horrible governmental sense, but I mean lead the American people's opinion to a better place. Hey, everybody, you know how you're sick and tired of this warfare? Well, you're right to be. We don't need it. It doesn't have to be this way. Vote Paul. Peacetime. And he could win. He could lead and he could win. Just by being right. Instead of trying so hard to please terrible people who don't deserve to be pleased and who could just as easy turn on a dime, you know? They're the same people who hate John McCain's guts and then all line up to vote for him anyway when he gets the nomination, right? We're talking about right-wingers. They can believe anything from one minute to the next with no consistency whatsoever other than mostly, you know, dishonesty and cruelty. But you could probably also say, hey, you believe in virtue too, right? And they go, huh, yeah, yeah, virtue. That's why it's such a disappointment the way he is. It's because all he would have to do is lead, state the peaceful position, and be right and win. Like I was just saying in the last segment, peace nicks in general. Left, right, center, and libertarian and everyone else ought to be grateful that Dick Cheney is leading the charge for intervention here. Completely discredits the entire theory of international politics. That this is what ought to be done is what this guy thinks. The worst American out of all of us. Why in the world should Rand Paul be afraid to get in a fight with him? You can't win a fight against Robert Kagan. Here's how you win a fight against Robert Kagan. You go up with your fingers splayed and you just touch his big fat belly. And you say, gee, Bob, for a tough guy, you seem pretty doughy. I'd like to see you spend 5 minutes out there on the ground in Afghanistan, tough guy. And then you get the whole entire peanut gallery laughing their asses off at big, fat, softy, whiny, pussy Bob Kagan. And then you're done. That's it. Yeah, Bob Kagan's a big, tough guy sending other people's sons to go kill and die. But Bob Kagan actually himself could be pushed down with one of Rand Paul's little pinky fingers. So go ahead. I mean, I assume that Rand Paul is like, you know, a softball type. He's a little bit athletic. Go ahead and mock and ridicule the warmongers. Mock and ridicule Dick Cheney. Mock and ridicule the former communists who became conservatives, who think that world revolution and unlimited inflationary and deficit spending is the way to make everything right in the world, and obliterate them with the meagerest of rhetoric. They couldn't possibly stand up to Rand Paul if he was taking a stand for the right cause, for peace, for sanity, for restraint, when the entire supermajority of the American people agree with that stance and he's backing away from it? The hell? Still no Obama speech. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
Side of Iraq. As I said last week, ISIL poses a threat to the Iraqi people, to the region, and to U.S. interests. So today I want to provide you an update on how we're responding to the situation. First, we are working to secure our embassy and personnel operating inside of Iraq. As president, I have no greater priority than the safety of our men and women serving overseas. So I've taken some steps to relocate some of our embassy personnel, and we've sent reinforcements to better secure our facilities. Second, at my direction, we have significantly increased our intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance assets so that we've got a better picture of what's taking place inside of Iraq. And this will give us a greater understanding of what ISIL is doing, where it's located, and how we might support efforts to counter this threat. Third, the United States will continue to increase our support to Iraqi security forces. We're prepared to create joint operations centers in Baghdad and northern Iraq to share intelligence and coordinate planning to confront the terrorist threat of ISIL. And through our new counterterrorism partnership fund, we're prepared to work with Congress to provide additional equipment. We have had advisors in Iraq through our embassy, and we're prepared to send a small number of additional American military advisors, up to 300, to assess how we can best train, advise, and support Iraqi security forces going forward. American forces will not be returning to combat in Iraq, but we will help Iraqis as they take the fight to terrorists who threaten the Iraqi people, the region, and American interests as well. Fourth, in recent days, we've positioned additional U.S. military assets in the region. Because of our increased intelligence resources, we're developing more information about potential targets associated with ISIL. And going forward, we will be prepared to take targeted and precise military action if and when we determine that the situation on the ground requires it. If we do, I will consult closely with Congress and leaders in Iraq and in the region. I want to emphasize, though, that the best and most effective response to a threat like ISIL will ultimately involve partnerships where local forces, like Iraqis, take the lead. Finally, the United States will lead a diplomatic effort to work with Iraqi leaders and the countries in the region to support stability in Iraq. At my direction, Secretary Kerry will depart this weekend for meetings in the Middle East and Europe, where he'll be able to consult with our allies and partners. And just as all Iraqi's neighbors must respect Iraq's territorial integrity, all of Iraq's neighbors have a vital interest in ensuring that Iraq does not descend into civil war or become a safe haven for terrorists. Above all, Iraqi leaders must rise above their differences and come together around a political plan for Iraq's future. Shia, Sunni, Kurds, all Iraqis must have confidence that they can advance their interests and aspirations through the political process rather than through violence. National unity meetings have to go forward to build consensus across Iraq's different communities. Now that the results of Iraq's recent election has been certified, a new parliament should convene as soon as possible. The formation of a new government will be an opportunity to begin a genuine dialogue and forge a government that represents the legitimate interests of all Iraqis. Now, it's not the place for the United States to choose Iraq's leaders. It is clear, though, that only leaders that can govern with an inclusive agenda are going to be able to truly bring the Iraqi people together and help them through this crisis. Meanwhile, the United States will not pursue military options that support one sect inside of Iraq at the expense of another. There's no military solution inside of Iraq, certainly not one that is led by the United States. But there is an urgent need for an inclusive political process, a more capable Iraqi security force, and counterterrorism efforts that deny groups like ISIL a safe haven. In closing, recent days have reminded us of the deep scars left by America's war in Iraq. Alongside the loss of nearly 4,500 American patriots. Many veterans carry the wounds of that war and will for the rest of their lives. Here at home, Iraq sparked vigorous debates and intense emotions in the past, and we've seen some of those debates resurface. But what's clear from the last decade is the need for the United States to ask hard questions before we take action abroad, particularly military action. So the most important question we should all be asking, the issue that we have to keep front and center, the issue that I keep front and center, is what is in the national security interests of the United States of America. As Commander-in-Chief, that's what I stay focused on. As Americans, that's what all of us should be focused on. And going forward, we will continue to consult closely with Congress. We will keep the American people informed. We will remain vigilant, and we will continue to do everything in our power to protect the security of the United States and the safety of the American people. So with that, I'm going to take a couple of questions. I'll start with Colleen McCain-Nelson of the Wall Street Journal.
Thank you, Mr. President. Do you have any confidence in Prime Minister Maliki at this point, and can Maliki bring political stability to Iraq?
As I said, it's not our job to choose Iraq's leaders. Part of what our patriots fought for during many years in Iraq was the right and the opportunity for Iraqis to determine their own destiny and choose their own leaders. But I don't think there's any secret that right now, at least, there is deep divisions between Sunni, Shia, and Kurdish leaders. And as long as those deep divisions continue or worsen, it's going to be very hard for an Iraqi central government to direct an Iraqi military to deal with these threats. And so we've consulted with Prime Minister Maliki, and we've said that to him privately. We've said it publicly that whether he is prime minister or any other leader aspires to lead the country, that it has to be an agenda in which Sunni, Shia, and Kurd all feel that they have the opportunity to advance their interests through the political process. And we've seen over the last 2 years, actually dating back to 2008, 2009, but I think worse over the last 2 years, the sense among Sunnis that their interests were not being served, that legislation that had been promised around, for example, de-Ba'athification had been stalled. I think that you hear similar complaints that the government in Baghdad has not sufficiently reached out to some of the tribes and been able to bring them in to a process that gives them a sense of being part of a unity government or a single nation state, and that has to be worked through. Part of the reason why we saw better equipped Iraqi security forces with larger numbers not be able to hold contested territory against ISIL probably reflects that lack of a sense of commitment on the part of Sunni communities to work with Baghdad, and that has to be fixed if we're going to get through this crisis. Jim Acosta.
Thank you, Mr. President. Americans may look at this decision that you're making today as a sneak preview of coming attractions, that the number of advisors that you're planning to send in may just be the beginning of a boots-on-the-ground scenario down the road. Why is Iraq's civil war in the national security interests of the United States, and are you concerned about the potential for mission creep?
I think we always have to guard against mission creep. So let me repeat what I've said in the past. American combat troops are not going to be fighting in Iraq again. We do not have the ability to simply solve this problem by sending in tens of thousands of troops and committing the kinds of blood and treasure that has already been expended in Iraq. Ultimately, this is something that is going to have to be solved by the Iraqis. It is in our national security interests not to see an all-out civil war inside of Iraq. Not just for humanitarian reasons, but because that ultimately can be destabilizing throughout the region. And in addition to having strong allies there that we are committed to protecting, obviously issues like energy and global energy markets continues to be important. We also have an interest in making sure that we don't have a safe haven that continues to grow for ISIL and other extremist jihadist groups who could use that as a base of operations for planning and targeting ourselves, our personnel overseas, and eventually the homeland. And you know, if they accumulate more money, they accumulate more ammunition, more military capability, larger numbers. That poses great dangers, not just to allies of ours like Jordan, which is very close by, but it also poses you know, a great danger potentially to Europe and ultimately the United States. We have already seen inside of Syria that, or groups like ISIL that right now are fighting with other extremist groups, or an Assad regime that was non-responsive to a Sunni majority there, that has attracted more and more jihadists or would-be jihadists, some of them from Europe. They then start traveling back to Europe, and that over time can create a cadre of terrorists that could harm us. So we have humanitarian interests in preventing bloodshed. We have strategic interests in stability in the region. We have counterterrorism interests. All those have to be addressed. The initial effort for us to get situational awareness through the reconnaissance and surveillance that we've already done, coupled with some of our best people on the ground doing assessments of exactly what the situation is, starting, by the way, with the perimeter around Baghdad and making sure that that's not overrun. That's a good investment for us to make. But that does not foreshadow a larger commitment of troops to actually fight in Iraq. That would not be effective in meeting the core interests that we have.
Just very quickly, do you wish you had left a residual force in Iraq? Any regrets about that decision in 2011?
Well, keep in mind, that wasn't a decision made by me. That was a decision made by the Iraqi government. We offered a modest residual force to help continue to train and advise Iraqi security forces. We had a core requirement, which we require in any situation where we have U.S. troops overseas, and that is that they are provided immunity at the since they are being invited by the sovereign government there, so that if, for example, they end up acting in self-defense, if they are attacked find themselves in a tough situation, that they're not somehow hauled before a foreign court. That's a core requirement that we have for U.S. troop presence anywhere. The Iraqi government and Prime Minister Maliki declined to provide us that immunity. I think it is important, though, to recognize that despite that decision, that we have continued to provide them with very intensive advice and support, and have continued throughout this process over the last 5 years to not only offer them our assistance militarily, but we've also continued to urge the kinds of political compromises that we think are ultimately necessary in order for them to have a functioning multi-sectarian democracy inside the country. Juliet Alper.
You just mentioned Syria a moment ago. Yeah. The United States has been slow to provide significant weapons and training directly to the Syrian opposition. Has the expansion of the Syria war into Iraq change your mind about the type of weapons and training you are now willing to give the opposition there? Is that what prompted Secretary Kerry to say of Syria, we are augmenting our assistance in significant ways, and can you elaborate on what you are doing now that you weren't doing before?
You know, that assessment about the dangers of what was happening in Syria have existed since the very beginning of the Syrian civil war. The question has never been whether we thought this was a serious problem. The question has always been, is there the capacity of moderate opposition on the ground to absorb and counteract extremists that it might have been pouring in, as well as an Assad regime supported by Iran and Russia that outmanned them and was ruthless. And so we have consistently provided that opposition with support. Oftentimes the challenge is if you have former farmers or teachers or pharmacists who now are taking up opposition against a battle-hardened regime with support from external actors that have a lot at stake, how quickly can you get them trained? How effective are you able to mobilize them? And you know, that continues to be a challenge. And even before the situation that we saw with ISIL going into Iraq, we had already tried to maximize what we can do to support a moderate opposition that not only can counteract the brutality of Assad, but also can make sure that in the minds of Sunnis, they don't think that their only alternative is either Mr. Assad or extremist groups like ISIL or al-Nusra.
And can you speak to what you might be doing differently, as the Secretary of State alluded to?
Well, I think that the key to both Syria and Iraq is going to be a combination of what happens inside the country, working with moderate Syrian opposition, working with an Iraqi government that is inclusive, and us laying down a more effective counterterrorism platform that gets all the countries in the region pulling in the same direction. And I alluded to this in the West Point speech. I talked about it today with respect to the Counterterrorism Partnership Fund. There's going to be a long-term problem in this region in which we have to build and partner with countries that are committed to our interests, our values, and at the same time, we have immediate problems with terrorist organizations that may be advancing. And rather than try to play whack-a-mole wherever these terrorist organizations may pop up, what we have to do is to be able to build effective partnerships, make sure that they have capacity. Some of the assets that have been devoted solely to Afghanistan over the last decade, we've got to shift to make sure that we have coverage in the Middle East and North Africa. You look at a country like Yemen, a very impoverished country, and one that has its own sectarian or ethnic divisions. We do have a committed partner in President Hadi and his government, and we have been able to help to develop their capacities without putting large numbers of U.S. troops on the ground. At the same time as we've got enough CT or counterterrorism capabilities that we're able to go after folks that might try to hit our embassy or might be trying to export terrorism into Europe or the United States. And looking at how we can create more of those models is going to be part of the solution in dealing with both Syria and Iraq. But in order for us to do that, we still need to have actual governments on the ground that we can partner with, and that we've got some confidence are going to pursue the political policies of inclusiveness in Yemen, for example, a wide-ranging national dialogue that took a long time but helped to give people a sense that there is a legitimate political outlet for grievances that they may have. Peter Mayer.
Thank you, sir. Going back to where you see Prime Minister al-Maliki playing a role at this point, you said that it's a time to rise above differences, that there's a need for a more inclusive government. Is he a unifier, and how much clout does the United States ultimately have with any of the leadership in Iraq at this point, really?
Well, we still provide them significant assistance. I think they recognize that, unlike some other players in the region, we don't have territorial ambitions in their country. We're not looking to control their assets or their energy. We want to make sure that we're vindicating the enormous effort and sacrifice that was made by our troops in giving them an opportunity to build a stable, inclusive society that can prosper and deliver for the basic needs and aspirations of the Iraqi people. And at the same time, they are a sovereign country. They have their own politics. And what we have tried to do is to give them our best advice about how they can solve their political problems. Now that they are in crisis, we are indicating to them that there's not going to be a simple military solution to this issue. If you start seeing the various groups inside of Iraq simply go to their respective corners, then it is almost certain that Baghdad and the central government will not be able to control huge chunks of their own country. The only way they can do that is if there are credible Sunni leaders, both at the national level and at the local level, who have confidence that a Shia majority, that the Kurds, that all those folks are committed to a fair and just governance of the country. Right now, that doesn't exist. There's too much suspicion. There's too much mistrust. And the good news is that an election took place in which, despite all this mistrust, despite all this frustration, despite all this anger, you still had millions of Iraqis turn out, in some cases in very dangerous circumstances. You now have a court that has certified those elections, and you have a constitutional process to advance government formation. So far, at least, the one bit of encouraging news that we've seen inside of Iraq is that all the parties have said they continue to be committed to choosing a leadership and a government through the existing constitutional order. So what you're seeing, I think, is as the prospects of civil war heighten, many Iraqi leaders stepping back and saying, let's not plunge back into the abyss. Let's see if we can resolve this politically. But they don't have a lot of time. And you have a group like ISIL that is doing everything that it can to descend the country back into chaos. And so one of the messages that we had for Prime Minister Maliki, but also for the Speaker of the House and the other leadership inside of Iraq is get going on this government formation. It'll make it a lot easier for them to shape a military strategy. It'll also make it possible for us to partner much more effectively than we can currently.
Given the Prime Minister's track record, is he a unifier? Can he play that role when, after what we've seen play out over the last couple of weeks is brought into play?
I think the test is before him and other Iraqi leaders as we speak. Right now, they can make a series of decisions. Regardless of what's happened in the past, right now is a moment where the fate of Iraq hangs in the balance. And the test for all of them is going to be whether they can overcome the mistrust, the deep sectarian divisions, in some cases just political opportunism, and say, this is bigger than any one of us, and we've got to make sure that we do what's right for the Iraqi people. And that's a challenge. That's not something that the United States can do for them. That's not something, by the way, that the United States armed forces can do for them. We can provide them the space. We can provide them the tools. But ultimately, they're going to have to make those decisions. In the meantime, my job is to make sure that American personnel there are safe, that we are consulting with the Iraqi security forces, that we're getting a better assessment of what's on the ground, and that we're recognizing the dangers of ISIL over the long term and developing the kinds of comprehensive counterterrorism strategies that we're going to need to deal with this issue. And that's going to involve some short-term responses to make sure that ISIL is not obtaining capacity to endanger us directly or our allies and partners. But it also is going to require some long-term strategies as well, because part of what we've seen with respect to ISIL is a broader trend that I talked about at West Point, rather than a single network, a discrete network of terrorists, this fluid combination of hardened terrorists, disaffected local leadership, and where there's vacuums, they're filling it and creating the potential for serious danger for all concerned. So, all right.
About Iran, Mr. President.
Thank you,
Iran. Any words on what you were willing to do?
With respect,
are you willing to work with them?
Our view is that Iran can play a constructive role if it is helping to send the same message to the Iraqi government that we're sending, which is that Iraqi only holds together if it's inclusive, and that if the interests of Sunni, Shia, and Kurd are all respected. If Iran is coming in solely as an armed force on behalf of the Shia, and if it is framed in that fashion, then that probably worsens the situation and the prospect for government formation that would actually be constructive over the long term.
What's your sense of that right now?
Well, I think that just as Iraq's leaders have to make decisions, I think Iran has heard from us. We've indicated to them that it is important for them to avoid steps that might encourage the kind of sectarian splits that might lead to civil war. The one thing that I think is has to be emphasized. We have deep differences with Iran across the board on a whole host of issues. Obviously, what's happened in Syria, in part, is the result of Iran coming in hot and heavy on one side. Iran obviously should consider the fact that if its view of the region is solely through sectarian frames, they could find themselves fighting in a whole lot of places, and that's probably not good for the Iranian economy or the Iranian people over the long term either. I suspect there are folks in Iran who recognize that. A Iraq in chaos on their borders is probably not in their interests, but old habits die hard, and we'll have to see whether they can take what I think would be a more promising path over the next several days. All right. Thank you very much, everybody.
President Obama announcing that the U.S. government will be sending up to 300 military advisors.
All right, you shut up. He said that these troops... All right, so that was Dear Leader. Oh, and we're still at break, so good.
The military-industrial complex. The disastrous rise of misplaced power.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here. I'd like for you to read this book, The War State, by Michael Swanson. America's always gone to war a lot, though in older times it would disarm for a bit between each one. But in World War II, the U.S. built a military and intelligence apparatus so large, it ended up reducing the former constitutional government to an almost ceremonial role and converting our economy into an engine of destruction. In The War State, Michael Swanson does a great job telling the sordid history of the rise of this national security state, relying on important first-hand source material, but writing for you and me. Find out how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy all alternately empowered and fought to control this imperial beast, and how the USA has gotten to where it is today. Corrupt, bankrupt, soaked in blood, despised by the world. The War State by Michael Swanson. Available at Amazon.com and at Audible.com. Or just click the logo in the right-hand margin at ScottHorton.org.
We should take nothing for granted.
Hey, yeah, that's supposed to play Dang Old Bobby right there. Dang Old Bobby, man. That's the Descendants. That ain't Second Chance. Oh, well, anyway, so, hey, I'm Scott, this is my show, welcome to the show. So that was Dear Leader talking about the dang thing, and, yeah, so, we're going back to war with Iraq. He's a liar. He says he's not sending troops, but, so what's his policy? Encourage Maliki to go back in time to the year 2007 and quit being a dick. Come on. Yeah, remember all those benchmarks that David Petraeus completely and utterly failed to achieve, such as the integration of the Sunnis into the government? Yeah, well, do that now, okay? Do that, and then everything will be fine. Patrick Coburn's reporting in The Independent, The Wall Street Journal's reporting as well that the White House wants Maliki out. Maliki's saying he ain't going anywhere. But what do they imagine is going to happen? And it was just a couple years ago when Iyad Alawi and his party actually won the majority in the elections. And yet Obama sided with Maliki and kept him. Iyad Alawi, he was the former CIA guy, the former Saddamist, before he was a CIA truck bomber, before he was the sock puppet dictator from 2003 through 2004. And even though he's a Shiite, he's always gotten along real well with the, you know, he used to be a Ba'athist, got along well with the Sunnis and was the compromise candidate. America sided with the Iranians and Maliki again. That's all in Dexter Filkin's piece at The New Yorker, which I didn't run at antiwar.com because he has this crap in there about how, oh, if only we'd stayed, things would have been better, which is a bunch of crap, obviously, but there was still a lot of good journalism in there anyway. And part of it was that Obama said, nah, come on, there's no question about it that Maliki gets to win, even though he lost. And it was America siding. Imagine that. The Iraqi people, in general, by their plurality in the election, preferred the former CIA agent to the Dawa Party guy. And anyway, now they're saying, okay, well, just compromise and everybody start getting along and then, you know, that'll marginalize ISIS. You hear that, Maliki? Allow, you know, rebothify the government. Invite all the awakening leader types that you refuse to broker into any of your deals, into all of your deals. Allow all of their armed men to be part of the Iraqi army and the Iraqi police force. You know, meet all those benchmarks that were obviously ridiculous from the very beginning, that were ridiculous when they were still being dreamt up as an excuse to double down on the war back in the fall of 2006. The beginning of the surge. Oh, the surge is working, the surge is working, the surge is working. They said it a million times. The surge is working, the surge is working. And then, Past tense. The surge worked. Look, everybody, the surge worked. Now, there was only one way to measure the surge, according to the authors of the surge, and that was the benchmarks. You know, we're talking about government, so everything has to have their ridiculous newspeak to everything. Well, we have these benchmarks to measure our progress in the surge. But by the time it came to changing the slogan from the surge is working to the surge worked, they just forgot about the benchmarks altogether. They never used the benchmarks as a measure of whether the surge had worked ever again. Because, of course, if they had broken out the benchmarks, they would have had to say, oh, yeah, no, the surge didn't work. Unless the real goal was kicking the last of the Sunni Arabs out of Baghdad. In which case, I guess, I mean, their goal of marginalizing Muqtada al-Sadr by attacking the Mahdi army didn't really work that well. They still needed him to ratify Nouri al-Maliki in the last two elections and his people to go along with it. So that part of the surge didn't work. And he was part of the ruling coalition that they were fighting for since 05 anyway. That whole thing was a fool's errand within a fool's errand. Muqtada al-Sadr, formerly known as most likely Shiite Arab leader to come to some kind of coalition agreement with the Sunni Arab leaders, no longer, after his Mahdi army helped lead the purge of Sunnis from, you know, in 06 and 07. But anyway, before that, so there you go, that's Obama's policy. So what I say is this, the policy amounts to full-scale invasion coming. He did not say, he did not address the existence now of a place called the Islamic State of Iraq. Did you hear the obfuscation on Syria? I literally phased out for a minute. I was trying to pay attention. And I phased out. I heard the second part of it, which was still speaking in such glittering generalities, is absolutely ridiculous. The problem in Syria is that Iran has backed Hezbollah? What are you talking about? Hezbollah's been fighting ISIS in Syria, you idiot, liar, evil warmonger. Saudi sock puppet. Israeli one. What in the world was he talking about? And saying, you know, Iran, yeah, we welcome Iran's intervention in Iraq to help the Iraqi government, but not if they're going to be sectarian about it. What? That's what the government in Iraq is. It's a sectarian government. Not if they're going to be sectarian about it. You know what the problem with Iran is? Is here they are backing Assad and Hezbollah in Syria just because they're the Shiites. Well, if that's how Iran's going to be, you know, sectarian, well, then we don't know if we want to work with them in Iraq. Well, first of all, America fought that entire war for Iran in the first place. As Jonathan Landay said yesterday, he was eyewitness when the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq came across the border from Iran into Iraq in 2003. On the heels of George Bush's invasion, and said, give me all the power, please, thank you. Abdulaziz al-Hakim and all of his minions and his Badr Brigade. The whole war was for Iran all along. Talk about not sectarian. America is the most sectarian fighter on all sides, really, but most especially on, for contradicting this argument, on the Shiite Iran side, at everybody. They've done more for Iran, for the mullahs that rule Iran, than anybody except the people who put them in power in Iran in 79 in the first place. And then secondly, you could complain that, yeah, oh, for sectarian reasons, Iran is backing the dictatorship in Syria. Okay, but America's backing their enemies in Syria. America's policy in Syria is completely and totally inconsistent with their policy in Iraq next door. ISIS in Iraq? Bad. ISIS in Syria? Just fine. Oh, their name is Islamic State of Iraq and Syria? Huh. Well, the first part of their name is bad, and the second part of their name is good. Huh? And now that border doesn't exist anymore because they erased it with bulldozers that they stole from George W. Bush, who left them behind with the keys in the ignition. So, Maybe Iran is sectarian for backing their ally, Assad. But America's sectarian on the side of Iran on one hand and on the side of Al-Qaeda on the other. So, who's worse? Who's killing more people? Amazing to listen to the president talk about this whole crisis. Well, the entire political establishment and all the hairdos on TV and all the rest of them, all the experts, the vast majority of them, they don't know what to say. They don't know how to approach it at all. That America's backing the suicide bombers in Syria and has been this whole time. They complain only that he hadn't backed the moderates enough. That's all they can think of to say. Even though everything they give to the moderates goes to ISIS and always has. And everyone's always known that. Hey, all, Scott here for Liberty.me, the brand new social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features nightly classes, guides, events, publishing, and so much more. Sign up now and you get the first 30 days free. And if you click through the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org or use the promo code Scott when you sign up, you'll save $5 per month for life. That's more than a third off the regular price. And hey, once you sign up, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, well, I had two guests on the show today, but then I bumped them both. Because I was waiting for Stupid to give a stupid speech. So he's sending a couple of hundred troops, special forces guys. Well, let's just go through this. Embassy reinforcements, that means Marines for the Green Zone. Escalation of spying satellites and drones and whatever. Okay, big deal. 300 advisors. 300 advisors. Men to run the joint operations centers that they're going to create. Trainers. And he emphasizes that they will not be fighting. They will be helping fight. It sounded to me like, yes, they will be going on missions with the Iraqi soldiers. They will be leading them into battle. Certainly before too long. The SEALs and the Rangers, according to Barbara Starr, which just means according to what they want us to think, not necessarily what's a fact, but that's what they're saying today. And then he says, yes, we're preparing airstrikes. He referred to, not explicitly, but I think it was pretty obvious he's referring to naval air power in the Gulf, ready to drop bombs when needed. I don't know if he really implied fleets of armed drones, but that'll be in there somewhere before too long as well. He says, we got to work with the neighbors, and we got to outsource this to the neighbors, and we have our new local counterterrorism fund, and we're going to help arm and train up the neighbors, and the neighbors, that's who's fighting. Iran and Saudi Arabia. Iran's backing the Shiites that America backed and put in power there, and Saudi Arabia is backing the Sunni-based insurgency that fought America and Iran all those years. You know, our good friends the Saudis. So you want to get the neighbors involved to solve this thing? I mean, I guess if he was being honest about it and saying, okay, let's get Iran and Saudi Arabia to the table and figure out how they can divvy up influence in Iraq in a way to get a minimum number of people killed, since after all, they will remain neighbors of Iraq forever. His whole damn speech was centered around the fake and ridiculous and false premise of a singular Iraqi nation state at all. He made it sound like, oh yeah, I mean, this is a doable thing, as Paul Wolfowitz might put it, that we're going to put it back together again. Yeah, what we'll do, we'll meet all those benchmarks. What we'll do, we'll say to the Iraqis, hey, meet the benchmarks, and then they will meet them. Yeah, and all the Sunni fighters will have jobs as cops and soldiers, and all the Sunni politicians will have jobs as politicians. And everyone will share the oil wealth, and they'll all rub butts in fields of flowers. Bada Brigade versus the Islamic State? Nah, who knows? Saudi, Iran? Never heard of that. The history of the last decade. What? No, what's going to happen is we're going to do benchmarks. Come on. Benchmark. Go ahead, benchmark. And then everything will be fine. We won't have to have a war there. That's his plan. Now, I'm not saying we need to have a war there. I need to make this abundantly clear. I think the U.S. government should stop existing. And then that'll be the best way to keep them from going back to Iraq, is there won't be them. Forget it. No more intervention. Not this way or that. Not for Iran, not for Saudi, not for ISIS, not for the Awakening Councils, not for anybody else. However, that's not the... And I got a whole argument about non-intervention will help really dry up the swamp of terrorist activity directed toward the United States, etc. like that. I'm really right about it. I have been all along. But... the thing of it is here is Obama is accepting, of course, all of the imperial and exceptional premises of American power. He's just saying he doesn't want to do anything about this now. But that is not tenable. That premise and that conclusion do not go together. And if there really is, and it remains to be seen how well they can pull this off. A bunch of people who suicide bomb their enemies to death. How long can those guys really last? I don't know. But if there really is a place called the Islamic State for I don't know what kind of period of time, a few months, they make Raqqa or Fallujah their capital and try to start sending ambassadors to the UN, I guess we don't have to go that far. If they start really making an Islamic State there and calling it that, and outright bin Ladenite in their tactics and in their language and in their recruiting and etc., then there will be carpet bombing. There will be full-scale intervention. There's no way that they're going to be able to get around that. Yes, I'm right, and Obama's right to stop and blame Bush for all this. There's a lesson here. You shouldn't start wars. How about full stop? You shouldn't start wars. This is what happens. However, he's not saying, listen, this is a terrible thing, but the best thing we can do is stay out of it because that will help it all settle itself in a way that at the very least, you know, will affect us least. But he's not really saying that. He's saying it's in our vital interest. We must protect the Islamic State. John McCain is right about everything except exactly what should be done. And then, so what does he want to do? He wants to send a few hundred advisors. I mean, I don't know what the deal is with this president, actually. He's funny. You gotta admit, at least he's not John McCain, but on the other hand, he's gonna have a John McCainian policy here in a minute anyway. He can't help but to. I mean, I don't know. I saw David Petraeus actually came out yesterday and said, look, we can't just be the Shiites Air Force. Well, that's what he was. He was a general for the Badr Brigade that whole time. You know, were they a puppet of his army or his army was a puppet of theirs, I think is much more apt. But now he's saying at least, hey, maybe it wouldn't be a good idea to help Maliki win this thing at this point and be in a position where what we do is we serve the interests of the Iranians and their militias. In other words, maybe it's time we stop doing that. It seems like pretty good cover for Barack Obama, but he didn't use it. He didn't make that case. He made the case for a terrible threat with minimalist intervention to stop it. And so, I mean, and he went on and on. He started elaborating during the follow-up questions. Well, now listen, you know, it's a very limited no. In fact, it was the question was, what about mission creep? Are you sure that you're not going to, you know, make this thing worse and worse? He says, no mission creep. Just, look, we have allies there, meaning the government of Iraq, that we must protect. Okay. That's a pretty damn big foot in the door right there. America must preserve the form of the government created by Bush and Sistani and their puppets back in 2004, okay? The Islamic Republic of Iraq, it is. Step one, must protect them. We must help them in their whatever missions against ISIS. We must protect our oil, as he put it, our energy interests. Got to keep those markets calm. Okay. And we must prevent Iraq from becoming a safe haven for terrorists. Oh, and we're back to why we can't cut and run circa this time 2003. Look what we did. Can't leave it like this. Hey y'all, Scott here. Like I told you before, the Future Freedom Foundation at FFF.org represents the best of the libertarian movement. Led by the fearless Jacob Hornberger, FFF writers James Bovard, Sheldon Richman, Wendy McElroy, Anthony Gregory, and many more write the op-eds and the books, host the events, and give the speeches that are changing our world for the better. Help support the Future Freedom Foundation. Subscribe to their magazine, The Future of Freedom. Or to contribute, just look for the big red donate button at the top of FFF.org. Peace and freedom. Thank you. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the Dang Show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Talking about going back to Iraq here. So, you know, they say they just, I guess they're going to try some kind of Awakening Council type thing again. I don't think it's going to work. I don't know. Those ISIS guys are real jerks, so the Sunni, local Sunnis may reject them. But work out a deal with Maliki? No. Here's the way I see it, and I could be wrong about this, but I'm not usually wrong about a lot of stuff. I don't know. And look, the fact that I'm right doesn't mean that the warring parties would see it my way and base their policy based on the facts as I appraise them. But it looks like a stalemate to me. The parts of the country that are majority Shiite are controlled by the majority Shiite government. And the parts of the country that are majority Sunni, not that it's perfect 50-50, but I'm saying majority here and majority there. Places where it's majority Sunni are now controlled by the tribal leaders and ISIS and the Baathists and the whatever coalitions of Sunni leadership they've got there. And Baghdad does not rule Fallujah, does not rule Mosul or Tikrit or etc. I forget now what's the status of Samarra. I think they had tried to take Samarra and they hadn't gotten it yet, so that may be an exception. But it seems to me, what I'm trying to say is that they're approximately at stalemate there. That's why the troops turned and ran. They turned and ran from territory that wasn't really their territory. But that doesn't mean they're giving up Baghdad or any of the land between there and Kuwait either. They're certainly going to fight like hell. They're not going to give up. I mean, they may lose, depending on how much money the Saudis are really willing to pay, I guess. They are going to fight like hell for Najaf and for Karbala and, for that matter, for Samarra, too. That may be a real point of contention here coming up. But Baghdad, I think, is safely in the hands of the Shiites, and I think the ISIS and the whatever Baathists would be crazy at this point to try to really do a full frontal assault and take it back. They can't. I don't think they have the power to do it. I think the Iraqi army plus the Shiite militias can keep them out of Baghdad. I mean, assuming they'll fight for it. You know, I don't know. Maybe Muqtada al-Sadr hates Maliki enough at this point that he wouldn't mind seeing these guys come and get rid of him. But I somehow doubt that. Apparently, Grand Ayatollah, the highest-ranking Shiite cleric in the world, higher than Khamenei, the supreme leader of Iran, based down there in Basra, he urged all fighting-aged males, Shia, obviously, to go and join the army. Not just to fight the ISIS, but to join the army to do so. So it sounds like the lines are, really what's happening here is just that the West is declaring independence from the East. And the East doesn't have any real ability to counteract it. It remains to be seen how it really shakes out, how much damage the Iranians and the Americans can do working together on behalf of the government that they've installed there. I guess back to my point, I think, you know, the fact of the Islamic State, the new Islamic State, it's just same as always. The results of every intervention become the excuse, the crisis for the next intervention. And in this case, it's almost impossible to argue against, I mean, unless you have a great explanation for how non-intervention is definitely, you know, peace. And staying out is definitely the best policy for directing terrorists elsewhere other than the U.S. and how counterproductive intervention can be. The narrative that here's a real problem, so therefore we have to shoot at it, coming out of the government is almost insurmountable. The only thing, and I keep harping on this, and don't misunderstand me like I'm spinning for the damned Israeli government or anything, but I'm just saying that it's ironical to me that I think mostly because, and you know, the American, there's a lot of the American establishment hates Iran for their own reasons, but mostly because of Israeli influence, Obama and his government and all of Congress have put in such a premium on taking Assad down a peg in order to weaken Iran by backing the Mujahideen in Syria this whole time. And by, you know, calling Assad Hitler and all of this kind of stuff, that they have basically, because they've adopted that narrative, it makes it too difficult for them to just finally come clean and say, okay, we, you know, enemy number one in the region now is ISIS, not Assad. And in fact, ISIS is his deadly enemy too. And so, maybe we ought to go back to the Bush Jr. policy of backing Assad, or at least stop backing the rebels against him when he's the one holding the line on ISIS over there. They can't say that. They can't admit it. Well, the problem is we're a bunch of traitors who put Israel before our own countrymen's interests. And so, yes, we've been backing the Al-Qaeda suicide bomber cousins of the 9/11 attackers against Hezbollah, because that's what Israel wants. Hezbollah that did not attack us on 9/11. They can't say that, and so, but instead, because of their treacherous policy, they can't just come clean and say, okay, clearly defined enemy territory here, the new Islamic State, invade it and bomb it. Thank God. Their treachery, and the fact that they're so beholden to the interests of a foreign power is actually helping restrain the war party at this point. Their narrative has too much dissonance in it, and they can't seem to work it out. Unbelievable, man. I gotta go back to, I'm sorry I'm just repeating myself on the show from day to day now, but this is worse than weapons of mass destruction, right? Like, you would have to be a damned fool to believe the lie that Saddam was gonna give chemical weapons he didn't have to Osama bin Laden to use against us here in America, or whatever nonsense that they were trying to push. But it was a consistent narrative in a way. I mean, it had its horrible flaws in it, you understand. I never believed it for a moment, of course. But compared to this, where ISIS is sort of not really specifically addressed in the case of Syria, but are actually the rebels that are constantly referred to as those who we've been backing and who need more backing, are the very same guys that are our enemies in Syria across the border. I mean, that is just absolutely unreal. It's unreal. How could the dumbest MSNBC goofball not hear this and object every time? I guess we did talk about it on the show, again with the repetition. Chuck Todd, who's my favorite because he's kind of a... He's the quintessential bimbo TV news reader. I mean, he has a certain speciality in counting votes in county precincts and that kind of thing. But otherwise, he didn't know anything about anything in the news or what's going on in the world. So, out of the mouths of babes, he says things like, it's funny, and this is right before all the to-do in Iraq in the last 2 weeks, right? It was 3 weeks ago that Chuck Todd said, it's funny that Al-Qaeda's on our side in Syria. Uh-huh. Isn't it? America's been backing Al-Qaeda in Syria. That's what he means. It's their fight. It's not America's fight in Syria. It's Nusra and ISIS. And their only difference of opinion is whether they want to obey Zawahiri or not. But otherwise, they all want the exact same bin Ladenite caliphate state. They'll have the exact same agenda and the exact same, you know, brutal methods of getting what they want too, in their atrocities against civilians and the rest. And even the newspaper of record, David Sanger, even. And I know it's a confirmation bias that it's not suspicious that it's David Sanger. It's even David Sanger, except it happens to be correct. So it's even David Sanger in the New York Times says that, yeah, whatever weapons they give to the so-called moderates end up in the hands of the extremists anyway. Because it's the extremists that are doing the fighting. That's what I've been saying on this show for 3 years straight now. There are no moderates among the suicide bombers. Against those who crucify their opponents to death in the town square.
Hey, Al Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
All right, you guys, wrapping up the show here. Thanks for listening. Less narrative, more news to try to finish up here. I think what Obama just announced was the beginning of full-scale war, because what he announced was the problem that needed solving did not match what he said he was going to do at all. Talking about preventing there being a safe haven for terrorists in Western Iraq. That's a loophole you could drive the Gulf of Tonkin through. It's on. And speaking of which, he also said, yeah, he'll consult Congress. And of course, Congress is worse than him. If it was up to them, he would just drop H-bombs on the place, right? Or I guess they would check with Ariel Sharon's corpse first and see what he said. I guess Netanyahu's a good enough stand-in. They're worse than him. But he says, yeah, I don't need their authority. I can bomb if I want. The AUMF from 2002 is still good. A little bit more dictatorial power by the president there, just to make sure to prove that he can. What are you going to do about it? That's right. You going to impeach him? When the Congress is worse than him, the Congress is going to impeach him for doing this without their approval? So much for that. Just another notch on his belt. That's all right. Par for the course. The unitary executive theory. And then he says, oh yeah, no, we wanted to stay. But Maliki wouldn't let us because he wouldn't give us immunity. Well, that much is true. But then he outright lied. He said, everywhere we station American troops, we have a deal that gives our soldiers immunity in order to stay there. But they wouldn't go along with it. Well, that's not true. American soldiers do not have immunity for crimes that they commit against civilians in Japan and in Korea and in Germany. They're subject to the local courts for many crimes anyway. And the status of forces agreements under those treaties, in those cases, the SOFAs don't stand in for treaties. They have actual treaties. But then the SOFAs, the Status of Forces Agreements, you know, they have particulars about certain kind of crimes are charged this way or that. But it is not the case that they demand complete imperial impunity from Japan, Germany, Korea, the way that they demanded it from the Iraqis. But then again, as everyone understands and accepts, those countries are already conquered and subjugated by the American Empire, and America keeps the American government's cronies and its allies, cronies in power in those countries, and they accept American forces there to keep their forces down as an excuse to not build up their forces and to stay within the broader policy of the American Empire. Call them the coalition of the willing, the bribed. But in Iraq, no, our guys need to be able to blow up whoever, whenever, and always get away with it. Different standard. So, if it was true what Obama claimed, that America demands the exact same kind of immunity everywhere that they base troops around the world, that would really be much worse, wouldn't it? What would that say about the American Empire? Or no, we're just here to help you. We love you, and not like in an Iraq, George Bush kind of way, but in a, yeah, we love having bases here in Germany, Japan, Korea, wherever else. But we must reserve the right to commit any crime against your civilian population that we feel like with no accountability ever. Jeez, at least their PR's a little bit better than that, right? Anyway, just a nice little example of Barack Obama lying his ass off. Obviously, he's the president of the United States. He knows that what he said about that is not true. But anyway, not like it's a big lie compared to the rest of them in this speech, but it was one. And then, they didn't ask him. Nobody asked him, hey, what about the Wall Street Journal says that you're saying no aid unless Maliki leaves, and Maliki's saying he won't go. Nobody asked him that. This press corps sucks, man. Don't you guys read the news, dude? Well, I was watching TV all day and they didn't mention that. Yeah, well, okay, guys. When you're the ones asking the questions, the rest of us are relying on you to at least read the news, okay? Oh, we hadn't heard that. The Wall Street Journal, do they have a TV show? Huh. Good job. All right, again, hundreds of Special Forces guys, air power, on their way to fight for Iran, to fight for the Hakim family, to fight for the Shia, to create a zillion more terrorists against the Americans. There you go. Also, I wanted to mention real quick, there's a new one at The Intercept about the NSA. How secret partners expand NSA's surveillance dragnet, and it has something to do with all the fiber optic cables under the ocean. Boy, that's quite a map of fiber optic cables. It's by Ryan Gallagher at firstlook.org/The Intercept. Got Fiber reads the NSA slide here. Yes, yes, they do got fiber. National Security Agency, collect it all, is their slogan. A new one at The Intercept. Oh, and man, you know what? Trevor Tim is supposed to come on next week, and I'll talk about this with him, but let me go ahead and mention it now, because it's really important, I think. And I don't understand it that well, so I won't explain it that well, but I think you'll kind of sort of get it. It's by Jennifer Granick at Wired. New ruling shows the NSA can't legally justify its phone spying anymore. And now, long of the short of it is that they've used this third-party doctrine to say, hey, if you know that the phone company knows who you called, then you have no expectation of privacy, no reason to, which is just ridiculous on its face. Never mind the, yeah, anyway, the details of the other thing coming up. It's just ridiculous on their face that if you agree, if you just know that obviously AT&T has a record of which numbers you called, that therefore you completely sacrifice any benefit of a claim that that is privileged information. Because as long as the phone company has it, then you should just know that they might share it with the government. Huh? It's not in the terms of service. It's not in the contract. And maybe that came from back in the day when AT&T was a federal agency, basically. There was a gun to every businessman in America's head that warned them that we'll kill you if you try to compete with AT&T. It's a felony. You may not. But anyway, they finally lifted that. So maybe that was their point, that everybody knows that AT&T is the NSA, stupid. So of course you have no expectation of privacy. Well, it's still a ridiculous ruling that if you do business with anyone, then by definition, if a business has record of your business with them, then that information is not privileged and belongs to the state. Huh? How about it belongs to the Martians? Or it belong, as long as we're making stuff up, and how about, and then you have to give Scott Horton $1 million every time that you tap a call. As long as we're dealing in complete non sequiturs here. But anyway, so that's been the ruling, the third party doctrine. That if you have reason to believe that anyone knows anything about you, then you have no reason to believe that it's not anyone else's business. Huh? And so, but that's now been struck down. And what happened was, the 11th Circuit Court on a different case. This was okay. It was a warrantless acquisition of business records, and this judge didn't directly address the old telephone tap and trace case, but instead cited a GPS tracking case where the Supreme Court got it right that no, the cops cannot just put a GPS on your car, because if they're keeping track of everywhere you're going, that information amounts to a search. Even though you're, you know, presumably out in public and trackable, compiling the information in such a way amounts to a whole new thing, where they have a map of your life and what you're doing and where you're going, and that's significant enough that it's a search. Well, so this judge has basically said, never mind that old expectation of privacy argument. I'm applying this expectation of privacy argument from a different ruling to the new case. And so we're going to talk about this with Trevor Tim coming up, but this could be somewhat significant, at least, for the future of NSA spying on Americans. Anyway, I'm sorry we're out of time. I had a lot more news, but see y'all tomorrow. Thanks for listening.